Welcome to Craftlit, the podcast for crafters who love books. My name is Heather Ordover, and I'm podcasting from my corner of the Sonoran Desert, the Old Pueblo, Tucson, Arizona. Episode 184, Wish You Were There. This episode of Craftlit is brought to you by Knitting Out Loud. Listen while you knit. You can find all of the books available from Knitting Out Loud at knittingoutloud.com. And Knit Circus magazine featuring three rings of knitting, sewing, and fun. You can check out the latest issue at www.knitcircus.com. And Writing a Life, the online writing tutorial service with a personal touch. You can find out more at writing-a-life.com. Well, hello! And I so wish you had been with us on the trip to London, Bath, and Wales. I'll have more information filtering out, and it's going to take a while just because there's a lot that I want to be able to do. But the upshot is this. Diane from Holiday Vacations is a genius, and I have proven once again that craftlit people are just better, because we had 31 fantastic people on this trip. It was amazing. It was one of those moments where, you know, this happens very rarely in life, where all of a sudden you meet people and you're like, oh, you're people like me. And they were, oh my gosh. So the final thing is this. Within the next couple of episodes, I will be able to announce real details on where the Craftlit Knitty trip will be for 2011. We are planning, I think we've already figured out what we want to do all the way through 2014. So it's not like these trips are going to go away. And talking to people on the trip, there were a number of people who are interested in the Craftlit Spa weekends. So once again, that is back on my front burner, and I will have information about that for you in the next few episodes as well. That'll be in the spring, probably the early spring, if all goes as planned. So that's very exciting. And let's see. Oh, I have audio for you. I have all sorts of stuff. It was fantastic. So more on that in a moment, because I also have a lot of other stuff for you. Obviously, with me being gone and with our internet options very limited, at two of the hotels, they wanted to charge £14.99 for 12 hours of internet access. This is ridiculous. That's like $25 for an evening, what would wind up being an evening. So the internet thing was really sketchy. And if I had turned on my phone to do what I normally do, you know, I can tweet from wherever I am or even upload stuff to my blogs and show notes and stuff, it would have cost a ridiculous fortune. So I'm sorry about that. I had anticipated being able to do more online stuff, but I now know more about how that could have been achieved for not an extortionary rate. So if you are traveling overseas, please do not hesitate to contact me and find out what I learned. I'm not going to bore everybody with details, but there are solutions. However, while I was gone, people continued to email, and I have a dumpster load of links for you. One is, I've been getting the Instructables updates. If you haven't discovered the Instructables website, I really get a kick out of them. And one of the things in preparation for Halloween, there is a pattern for sewing a Where the Wild Things Are hat, just like Max's. And it really actually looks quite good. So I've included the link to that pattern. Let's see. I've included a link to a Jane Austen Colin Firth article that Marla sent in. Precision Pumpkin Carving, again from Instructables. Links to the Flickr group and the Craftlit group page on Facebook and the Craftlit fan page on Facebook. It's very confusing. They started, Facebook started with the group pages and then they added the fan pages and they've just been tap dancing on my last nerve. But people who went on the trip should be able to post to all three of those sites, depending on what your inclinations are. The Flickr group, the Craftlit group, or the fan page on Facebook. So lots of pictures. I know Amy has posted hers on Flickr, and my husband has added his to Facebook. And, you know, I've put mine up there. There's... It was ridiculous how many pictures we were taking. Digital photography does that to me. You know, just kind of taking lots of pictures because I can. And I tried to do as many landscape pictures as I could where, you know, I would move the camera like from the left to the right and just kind of take a panoramic click, 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 click all the way around so that even though you're not there, you could really see like Stonehenge. I went to Stonehenge the day before the tour started with Jenny the Potter's mom, Lucinda. And the pictures you see of Stonehenge are always kind of awe-inspiring and beautiful. There it is, kind of on this rise on the Salisbury Plain. And that's all well and good. But for all you know, there could be, you know, skyscrapers behind you. It could have been all built up. And it's not. And they've done a really nice job keeping the car park kind of out of sight as well. And so I took pictures from Stonehenge turning all the way around to my right to where you can see people walking in. And you can see that the car park actually isn't visible when you are at Stonehenge proper. So I tried to make the pictures good. The one picture I didn't get from that part of the excursion was the picture of the mystic badger that rescued Lucinda and me while we were driving. I drove while in the UK, which was kind of funny because not only did I drive, but I had hired a car. I had hired the smallest car I could because I didn't know if we'd be going down any of those, you know, really narrow country tracks or if I'd be on major streets the whole time, because we weren't just going to Stonehenge. We were going to go up to Avebury, which is a larger stone circle. Actually, I think it's the largest and the only one that has a pub in the center. So how can you say no? So we're driving along in a car that is not only tiny, but in trying to get a very small car, I wound up with one that is a stick shift in my left hand, which is not how I normally do stick shift. So it was an adventure, and Lucinda is the calmest human on the planet. So I actually was doing pretty well because Lucinda was doing really well. And then we continued to get lost. Google Maps did not help us as much as we thought they would. And I couldn't, neither of us could turn on our phones to get GPS because it would have cost a fortune. So we just got lost. Well, as we were driving to Stonehenge before we got lost, we drove by a badger that was dead on the side of the road. And at first I didn't say anything. And then I thought, wow, Lucinda, that was a badger. And she said, I know, I saw that too. And we were talking about the fact that we see raccoons in the United States, maybe the odd skunk, but not so much the badger thing. So it had been a topic of conversation. Later that night, as it's getting dark, we're driving along lost. And suddenly we pass a badger. And I looked at her and I said, Lucinda, I think that was our badger. I think we're almost to Stonehenge. And as I said it, we came up over a rise and there was Stonehenge. And therefore, we knew exactly where we were and how to get back. And it was all because of the mystic badger. Because it was getting just dark enough that we actually could have missed Stonehenge if because it's not lit at night. We could have missed it if we hadn't seen our mystic badger. And then as we approached Salisbury, a city for which we had no map, and a city for which one really needs not just a map, but a private tour guide. As it got darker and darker, I said, well, it could be worse. Could be raining. And then it started raining. So, you know, it was one of those nights, but Lucinda kept laughing, and therefore I kept laughing, and it all worked out just fine. But my last words of advice are always look for a mystic badger. And if you are going to drive in the town of Salisbury, hire someone to go with you. Because I swear to you, that is what the girl at the hotel told us to do. She told us when we called and said we were lost, she called and said, go knock on someone's door and ask them to tell you where it is. Like, you know, we are not in the United States anymore. And that really sold it. I've never actually been given instructions like that ever. So that was kind of fun. Along with all of that in the UK, we got to meet the Cardiff Knitters. And as a consequence, we got onto the Casting Pod. I have a link to that podcast for you. And here is an actual message to you from Josie.
Hello, Heather. It's Josie here from Casting Pods. It was great to see you last Wednesday and see everybody else as well. I'd like to just say hello to everybody that I met on Wednesday night in Cardiff, especially to Ms. Adams, who I spent most of the night with. It was so packed in that room, it was very difficult to tart myself around like I would have liked. I've been burning the candle at both ends, so to speak, because just before we were due to meet, I thought, oh, wouldn't it be a good idea to have a listen to some of the most recent episodes so that I could catch up just in case there was anything, you know, really big in your life that I would totally ignore when I met you. Because, as you know, I mentioned that I'm still in the middle of Dickens at the moment, Tale of Two Cities, in my catching up. And quickly realised that you've only just recently started the Connecticut Yankees. So I thought, well, what I'm going to do is I'm just going to listen to the latest one and also catch up. And while I'm talking about catching up, I would heartily recommend doing it. Anybody that I've just been listening from whichever book they started with, I would heartily recommend going back and listening to some of the earlier books. Not just because they're fabulous. I loved The Turn of the Screw. Obviously, Jane Austen, obviously, Pride and Prejudice is a real classic. And it's not just from being able to listen to them, but listening to all the things that you talk about the books. And just generally, I loved all your discussion on Gandhi. And the talk is as much the important thing as the actual listening to the book for me. Oh, yeah, and Sleepy Hollow. Oh, my God, that was fabulous. So Dickens, I'm kind of closing in on book three now with Tale of Two Cities. And hearing all the things that you're talking about with Madame Defarge and her knitting and the vengeance. And I did read this book when I was 14. It was one of our set texts in school. But because I had some really disjointed education and I ended up only studying the first few chapters in class, but I did read the whole of the book because once I'd started, I was completely riveted, engrossed, and it's just so compelling. At the time, I was knitting probably more than I knit now. I was using knitting as a kind of a defence mechanism or therapy or something. But oddly, I didn't actually remember the knitting theme with Madame Defarge until listening to Craftlit and listening to you talking about her knitting. And the whole thing with the codes and all of that just must have completely gone over my head as a 14-year-old. If I thought about it at all, I would have probably taken it quite literally when Dickens said Madame Defarge was knitting and she saw nothing and she heard nothing, because that was kind of how it was for me when I was knitting, that knitting would put me into almost like putting me into a trance, and it was a way of disassociating myself from the outside world and just sort of opting out really of all the horror that was going on around me. And if I thought at all about what Madame Defarge was doing when she was knitting, then I was probably thinking that it would be comparable to what I was doing at the time when I was knitting. So that's my thoughts on that. I mean, obviously, you know, once you point out that the passages that demonstrate that she's knitting some kind of a code into her items, garments, whatever it is, shrouds that she's knitting, then that makes perfect sense as an adult. And the vengeance that you say is an allegorical character. Now, again, as a child, I didn't really see the vengeance. I mean, I suppose I did understand the concept of allegorical characters, but to me, the vengeance was just this amazing woman who was like Wonder Woman or something. I don't know, like a dark Wonder Woman. You kind of, when you're talking about it, you're so negative, but what you don't see is that somebody who's been through a horrendous traumatic kind of experience or some kind of long-term trauma, some kind of long-term oppression, this kind of character who goes around just wreaking vengeance on the previous oppressors would be seen as a heroic figure. And for me, when I was 14, she was actually my favourite character. And I even had a secret nickname for myself, that I was the Vengeance. And that the Vengeance, I think I might have even drawn some kind of a comic book cartoon character of this fat woman who just went around killing anybody who tried to bully her for being fat, really. So yeah, the Vengeance. And again, I'd forgotten all about that until she started cropping up in my earphones from Craftlet. Yeah, I've just finished uploading the latest episode of Casting Pods, where I'm talking a bit about how I met you and Brenda Dane and all of the other people. And the crazy week I've been having, one of the things that I wanted to just tell you about was that it was my gran's funeral on Saturday, and it was my 40th birthday on Sunday. And on Saturday afternoon, driving back from my gran's funeral, I had a birthday treat booked Saturday afternoon that I was going to. And it was listening to Craftlet that sustained me for that journey. It was having you and Tale of Two Cities on the iPod as I was driving back that got me through it. And amazingly, coincidentally, the episodes that I was listening to were the ones where you're talking about your own 40th birthday. So how about that for synchronicity? Okay, so now I'm listening to the current book. Hopefully you will hear more from me with my various literary comments about it. Okay, bye-bye.
Everyone we met in Cardiff was wonderful. We got to meet a lot of dyers, hand dyers in Cardiff, and I got a little bit of lace weight yarn from King Becky. I have linked to her and her Etsy store from the show notes. She does really interesting stuff. I did not purchase her more interesting sock yarn, which she double dyes, so one side is like really black and one side is really neon, and that's just how she's dyed up the skein, and it looks really cool. But she was all out of one of the colors that I kind of liked, so I will continue to check her Etsy store and see when that color pops back up again. But really interesting stuff, and she's just adorable and sweet. And we met Marie Ershad from Knitcast, which of course is kind of a heroic moment because there you are meeting the very first of the knitting podcasters. And she's adorable and wonderful. And I know she talked to me on the bus. I think she talked to Amy too. And so at some point we will pop up on Knitcast and I will make sure that I let you know when that is as well. We also, I got a couple of support things in the emails. Donors Choose. In the beginning, Donors Choose was just for New York City teachers, and I used Donors Choose after 9/11 to get books for my students because, you know, we had to run with nothing, and that meant we couldn't get back into the building for months to get any of our supplies. So we were teaching without books, without backpacks, without paper. And a lot of that stuff came in as donations in the early days, but there were other things that we didn't have. Knitting supplies were one of them for teaching the kids how to knit, to kind of help them calm down after 9/11, but other things, books and I'm trying to remember what other supplies I wound up getting through Donors Choose. Oh, a projector so that we could do it all off of a laptop since we didn't have internet. And honestly, the school that we were evacuated into didn't want us using their chalk. So easier if I could carry around a projector and just hang it. So Donors Choose was a place, and still is, a place where teachers can go in and type in what they need. And then people can go in and fund a portion of or all of their requests. So if you only have $10 to spare, but you feel that this is a worthy effort, then you can pledge $10 towards the project. It's kind of like Kickstarter.com, but all for teachers. And now teachers all around the country, I think, can use Donors Choose. Well, a friend of mine from my old school, who evacuated with us and who is now teaching at a different high school, she has put in a request for her students. These are college-bound inner-city children who don't have much. And, of course, budgets are getting axed everywhere. And if you feel like throwing, you know, a couple bucks her way, there is a link to her Donor Choose website from the show notes. We also have a note from Leanne. Leanne is a listener, and I actually have copied and pasted part of her email message to me. She has a friend whose the family is trying to raise money for medical bills, and one of the things that they do is that they are selling on this Etsy site hand-drawn monster pictures drawn by the five-year-old boy who was diagnosed with ALL, a form of leukemia. There's a blog, which I also have a link to, and of course there's a PayPal donation button. Again, if you want to just toss a couple bucks, every penny counts, especially when it's your kid and they are ill. So that is up on the show notes as well. Patty, who was on our trip, emailed to let us know that her knitting store sent out a message that there are a bunch of kids in upstate New York who get together after school and listen to books on tape, and they knit. And then they donate the things that they have knit. They usually do kind of quilt squares, and then they crochet them all together, and it's knitting and crocheting group. Anyway, their program, which doesn't require a whole lot in the way of funding, could be eliminated in the next round of budget cuts. Clorox is doing this same kind of funding thing where if you get enough votes, you get funded. So this requires no money on your part. You can go to the website that we link to from the show notes, vote for this particular group, and the end result is that you get a Clorox coupon. You do have to put in your email and stuff like that. Did I ever tell you what I did about this? I created a email address, and it's the one that anytime people ask for my email in relationship to purchasing something or getting something or this kind of thing where, you know, oh, we want to, you know, keep you informed about our stuff, I give them that email address, and then I never look at it. Sometimes I do. I go, oof, you know, like a Borders coupon or something, or a Michael's coupon. It all goes into that particular email address. But that way it doesn't clutter my other inbox. So that's what's worked for me. I also have a link to a really lovely video. Many of you know who the Indigo Girls are, and some of you know that my husband went to school with them. Well, he went back to Emory University for his reunion, and Emily spoke, and then Emily and her father did a symposium, a conversation at the university about creativity and about spirituality. And I don't know if you know, you know that Indigo Girls songs are often mad deep, yo. And one of the reasons is because Emily's father is a professor in the theology department. So they have a very interesting family and a very interesting family background. And they are both two of the loveliest people you could ever hope to listen to for an hour. So I have actually embedded the video of the two of them talking into the show notes. And, you know, if you just want to put it on in the background and kind of listen to a really calm, sane, adult, interesting conversation about the nature of creativity and the origins of creativity, it seemed appropriate to our milieu, as it were. So I have that up for you. I also have a link to a cloth, paper, scissors video. This is on how to use resin in jewelry making. I've always been intrigued by this, but I have feared it. And I no longer fear it. It's not something I'm going to do soon because it would require buying more supplies, and that's not going to happen. But it looks easier than I thought. And there were some really interesting tricks that she shared. There's a new book coming, or a new DVD collection coming out. And so this is kind of a way to promote that DVD, but also give some really good, decent information. So that is out. The poll is still up for what book you want to listen to next. And I'm going to be adding a book to that, because when I was in London and we went to the iKnit meetup, I got to meet some lovely people. I got to see a little grommet. Somebody had knitted a grommet, and I was hoping that they had the pattern, but they didn't, although they're looking to see if it's buried somewhere. I hope so, because it was really adorable. But I got to meet some listeners, including listeners who are who were English majors and who had lots of books to share and ideas of good books. So I'm going to add some, and I've included a little bit of an email on that regard. Don't forget, the Lewis Creek sock pattern is available at the craftlot.com show notes. That is in the left-hand sidebar, available for you. And Writing a Life, as you heard in the intro, Writing a Life, the tutorial site brought to you by the good people at Craftlit, is now open and ready for business. If you follow the link from the Craftlit show notes, you, as a Craftlit listener, will get a discount on the services. Everybody else has to go to the regular main page, and they just have to pay the normal fees. But for you, a little something for being a listener. So that is up and running. And even if you don't have kids, or you personally don't need help with your writing, but you know someone who might, or you know some families who might need a little help, please, please, please forward them the link. It would be such an enormous help to me, and kind of a passive, easy way to help out the show. Any age kid who's capable of getting on a computer and typing, or at least getting on Skype or an online classroom and communicating, we can help. We also work with college students and adults in business situations with business writing. Right now, I am the main tutor, but I have three on deck, all of whom have taught middle school up through college. So that's where that's at. I'm very excited about it. I have an online classroom ready to go and all sorts of stuff. So that's very fun. Another way to support Craftlit, if you are so inclined, in a kind of passive way, is if you are going to shop at Amazon, especially with the holiday season coming and all of that, but if you're going to shop at Amazon and you don't mind helping out the show a bit, go to craftlit.com, and at the end of each one of the show notes and in the sidebar, you'll see two different ways to support the show. One, in the sidebar, I have a link just to a copy of Connecticut Yankee. You don't have to buy that, but if you click on that link to the Amazon page, or if you click on the advertisement link, there's a banner ad at the bottom of the show note, either one of those takes you into Amazon. Once you leave the craftlit.com site and head into Amazon, Amazon remembers that you came from Craftlit. So anything you purchase, having followed the link from the Craftlit page, gets credited back to the Craftlit affiliate account. And that all goes to the show. So, you know, if you are so inclined, or you remember and you think about it, it would be a huge help to my ability to keep the show running for the next however long it takes for us to finish, let's see, every good book in the world. I think that pretty much sums it up, because everywhere I go, people are like, ooh, have you thought about this? Ooh, have you thought about this? I have so many books on deck for this show that we could easily make it into the next century. It's just fantastic, which is great, because, you know, there is no end to good books. Saying that, however, I know that some of you are a wee bit frustrated with Connecticut Yankee. And I know there are some of you who were on the trip even, who said, you know, the only reason you're sticking with it is because you trust me. Because I told you that Frankenstein was not the book you thought it was, and you turned out to love Frankenstein. Or Tale of Two Cities was not the book either of us thought it was, and we all wound up loving Tale of Two Cities. And so, you know, you're hanging in there. And Twain is a genius, especially, you know, the way he turns a phrase, the way he uses language for humorous effect. That stuff, it's like Douglas Adams. I mean, it just doesn't get better than that. So there's that Twain genius. But Twain is a flawed writer in a number of his books. There are things that he does where you just go, really? Oh, you know, Huck Finn, the last third of the book. He was never happy with it. He was never happy with how it wound up. And this is one of his later books. It is not Tom Sawyer. It is not a happy-go-lucky book. It is, however, I think, a deeply important book to know. Unfortunately, you have to wait for the last five chapters before you get the kick in the teeth that he's been building to. The next section that we're getting into is good, and it's interesting, and it is another one of these anachronistic criticisms of him, of his, where he is using the 6th century and the Sir Walter Scott kind of stuff, that whole oeuvre, and he is using it to criticize things that are going on in his own day, which is, you know, another one of those genius moments that he is able to let you think you're reading a book that's making fun of Sir Walter Scott, or reading a book about an interesting thing that happened in the 6th century, or a precursor to science fiction by using a time travel device. You know, he lets you think all of that, but what he's really doing is he's being very, very, very critical of the society that he lives in. And as we, at kind of, as you turn the corner past chapter 20, which we've done recently, you start to get further and further into his real point. And I haven't found anything yet. I'm still reading, but I haven't found anything yet. But my suspicion is this. Twain comes up with a cute idea. Oh, let's rip on Sir Walter Scott and have a guy go back in time. You know, a really solid 19th century industrialist who is the quintessential, not only Yankee, but kind of quintessentially American, in that he's very inventive and he creates things and he problem solves. And he's also kind of a big teenager and galumphs around and doesn't really understand how he's being perceived by everybody else, and just, you know, can't believe how dumb the rest of the world is, which kind of fits in with Twain's comment. What was it? When I was 18, I couldn't believe what an idiot my father was. And when I turned 21, I was surprised by how much he'd been able to learn in 4 years. That kind of thing. Well, I think one of the things that happened to Twain, and not just here, but in some of his other books as well, is that he may start thinking that he's just going to write a simple satire or a simple comedic novel, even Prince and the Pauper. And like Dickens, who was incapable of writing something without making critical comments about the society that he lived in, Twain can't avoid it either. So the thing that's interesting, and the thing that you will start to notice more and more about Connecticut Yankee, is we started off criticizing courtly tradition. And there was the whole Morgan Le Fay chapter about how, you know, she felt that it was okay to have stabbed the page just because he stumbled and fell. And it was okay, not because he deserved it, but because she paid the family. That goes straight back to slavery in the United States. It starts, yeah. It starts in old-fashioned clothes, and it starts with the cute eclipse thing, and then you get the kind of shock at the world, but you still get the courtly tradition and the jousting and all of that. And then you get into the Merlin and the well thing, and you start to realize that while he's whining and complaining about how these people are in thrall to superstitions and what they perceive of as magic, and he says that what he really wants is for people to be logical and rational and you know, problem solve appropriately and all this stuff, he uses, and I know we've talked about this before, he uses that superstitious nature to, well, he uses it exactly the same way that it's being used already. He does it in order to get people to follow him and to side with him. And, you know, he's the boss. And he clearly loves being the center of attention. It's hard because the tone of the boss is very similar to Twain. You know, if you've read Roughing It or any of his more autobiographical texts, this guy sounds like Twain, but he's not. This is so important to remember. Twain called him a jackass, and he is. He is a doof. He's completely self-involved. He is incapable of seeing the world through any eyes except for his 19th century Yankee point of view, which, you know, Americans get slammed at even today for doing that. And I think everyone on the trip to London, Bath, and Wales, we were all, to a number, I think we were all very relieved to be traveling when the Americans weren't there in force. And it's embarrassing to say that, but, you know, we had our chatty moments and we had fun, but none of us walked up to a maitre d' or anyone and started yelling because our milk wasn't cold enough. You know, I've been there when that's happened before, when I traveled in the summer. So, you know, that Twain traveled a lot. Twain had been around the world. Twain had seen how America was perceived. And you're going to start getting into his really biting, far more acerbic satire as we head towards those last final chapters, which are gut-wrenching. I really don't think I'm exaggerating what happens at the end. You can tell me. When we get there, you can email and say, you know, Heather, you made me think it was going to be good, but eh. Or, you know, you can put it in the show notes that, yes, I did not lead you astray. So, thank you for sticking with me and trusting me. I will do my best to make sure that it all pays off for you. And today, we have chapters 27 and 28. Now, when last we left our intrepid boss, he was planning on taking off to go see what life was really like for people of the peasant class. And that's great, but now Arthur wants to go. And the last thing we saw was Arthur doing the king's evil thing, where he was blessing people who were sick and handing out money and, you know, being the beneficent ruler and all of that. Well, now they hit the road. And first, it requires preparation. And and some of the preparation is physical, and some of the preparation is mental. And as you might imagine, it's a little harder to get the king to come down to the level of a man than it is for a man to rise to the level of king. So we get a lot of the humorous situation setup stuff in today's two chapters. However, it doesn't take long before something resembling seriousness starts to creep in, and you'll start to notice that the heightened level of danger is not a joke, and that's going to continue to build over the next couple of episodes. And you get the first inklings of it with today's chapters. Next week chapters are actually heartbreaking. I was drawn to tears, but that's for next week. So this week is, you know, putting the chess pieces in order. We have chapters like this in every book from time to time. Some of it funny, but all of it foreshadowing things to come. I'm trying to remember if there's anything else tricky about these. I think all the interesting tricky stuff comes with next week. So here we go with chapters 27 and 28 of A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court.
Chapter 27, The Yankee and the King Travel Incognito. About bedtime, I took the king to my private quarters to cut his hair and help him get the hang of the lowly raiment he was to wear. The high classes wore their hair banged across the forehead, but hanging to the shoulders the rest of the way around, whereas the lowest ranks of commoners were banged fore and aft both. The slaves were bangless and allowed their hair free growth. So I inverted a bowl over his head and cut away all the locks that hung below it. I also trimmed his whiskers and mustache until they were only about a half inch long. I tried to do it inartistically and succeeded. It was a villainous disfigurement. When he got his lubberly sandals on and his long robe of coarse brown linen cloth, which hung straight from his neck to his ankle bones, he was no longer the comeliest man in his kingdom, but one of the unhandsomest and most commonplace and unattractive. We were dressed and barbered alike, and could pass for small farmers, or farm bailiffs, or shepherds, or carters. Yes, or for village artisans, if we chose, our costume being in effect universal among the poor because of its strength and cheapness. I don't mean that it was really cheap to be a very poor person, but I do mean that it was the cheapest material there was for male attire, manufactured material, you understand. We slipped away an hour before dawn, and by broad sunup had made 8 or 10 miles, and were in the midst of a sparsely settled country. I had a pretty heavy knapsack. It was laden with provisions for the king to taper down on, till he could take to the coarse fare of the country without damage. I found a comfortable seat for the king by the roadside, and then gave him a morsel or two to stay his stomach with. Then I said I would find some water for him, and strolled away. Part of my project was to get out of sight and sit down and rest a little myself. It had always been my custom to stand when in his presence, even at the council board, except upon those rare occasions when the sitting was a very long one, extending over hours. Then I had a trifling little backless thing which was like a reversed culvert and was as comfortable as the toothache. I didn't want to break him in suddenly, but do it by degrees. We should have to sit together now when in company, or people would notice. But it would not be good politics for me to be playing equality with him when there was no necessity of it. I found the water some 300 yards away, and had been resting about 20 minutes when I heard voices. That is all right, I thought. Peasants going to work, nobody else likely to be stirring this early. But the next moment these comers jingled into sight around a turn of the road, smartly clad people of quality, with luggage mules and servants in their train. I was off like a shot through the bushes by the shortest cut. For a while it did seem that these people would pass the king before I could get to him, but desperation gives you wings, you know, and I canted my body forward, inflated my breast, and held my breath and flew. I arrived, and in plenty good enough time, too. Pardon, my king, but it's no time for ceremony. Jump, jump to your feet, some quality are coming.
Is that a marvel? Let them come.
But, my liege, you must not be seen sitting. Rise, and stand in humble posture while they pass. You are a peasant, you know.
True, I had forgot it. So lost was I in planning of a huge war with Gaul.
He was up by this time, but a farm could have got up quicker if there was any kind of a boom in real estate.
And right so a thought came randoming overthwart this majestic dream, the which—
A humbler attitude, my lord the king, then quick. Duck your head. More, still more. Droop it. He did his honest best, but lord, it was no great things. He looked as humble as the Leaning Tower of Pisa. It is the most you could say of it.
Indeed, it was such a thundering poor success that it raised wondering scowls all along the line, and a gorgeous flunky at the tail end of it raised his whip, but I jumped in time and was under it when it fell, and under cover of the volley of coarse laughter which followed, I spoke up sharply and warned the king to take no notice. He mastered himself for the moment, but it was a sore tax. He wanted to eat up the procession. I said, "It would end our adventures at the very start, and we, being without weapons, could do nothing with that armed gang. If we are going to succeed in our emprise, we must not only look the peasant, but act the peasant."
"It is wisdom. None can gainsay it. Let us go on, Sir Boss. I will take note and learn, and do the best I may."
He kept his word. He did the best he could, but I've seen better. If you have ever seen an active, heedless, enterprising child going diligently out of one mischief and into another all day long, and an anxious mother at his heels all the while, and just saving it by a hair from drowning itself or breaking its neck with each new experiment, you've seen the king and me. If I could have foreseen what the king was going to be like, I should have said, "No, if anybody wants to make his living exhibiting a king as a peasant, let him take the layout. I can do better with a menagerie and last longer." And yet, during the first 3 days, I never allowed him to enter a hut or other dwelling. If he could pass muster anywhere during his early novitiate, it would be in small inns and on the road. So to these places we confined ourselves. Yes, he certainly did the best he could, but what of that? He didn't improve a bit that I could see. He was always frightening me, always breaking out with fresh astonishers in new and unexpected places. Toward evening on the second day, what does he do but blandly fetch out a dirk from inside his robe? "Great guns, my liege! Where did you get that?"
"From a smuggler at the inn, yester-eve."
"What in the world possessed you to buy it?"
"We have escaped divers dangers by wit, thy wit, but I have bethought me that it were but prudence if I bore a weapon too. Thine might fail thee in some pinch."
"But people of our condition are not allowed to carry arms. What would a lord say? Yes, or any other person of whatever condition, if he caught an upstart peasant with a dagger on his person."
It was a lucky thing for us that nobody came along just then. I persuaded him to throw the dirk away, and it was as easy as persuading a child to give up some bright, fresh, new way of killing itself. We walked along, silent and thinking. Finally the king said, "When ye know that I meditate a thing inconvenient, or that hath a peril in it, why do you not warn me to cease from that project?" It was a startling question, and a puzzler. I didn't quite know how to take hold of it, or what to say, and so, of course, I ended up by saying the natural thing.
"But, sire, how can I know what your thoughts are?"
The king stopped dead in his tracks and stared at me. "I believed thou wert greater than Merlin, and truly in magic thou art, but prophecy is greater than magic. Merlin is a prophet." I saw I had made a blunder. I must get back my lost ground. After a deep reflection and careful planning, I said,
"Sire, I have been misunderstood. I will explain. There are two kinds of prophecy. One is the gift to foretell things that are but a little way off. The other is the gift to foretell things that are whole ages and centuries away. Which is the mightier gift, do you think?"
"Oh, the last, most surely."
"True. Does Merlin possess it?"
"Partly, yes. He foretold mysteries about my birth and future kingship that were 20 years away."
"Has he ever gone beyond that?"
"Oh, he would not claim more, I think."
"It is probably his limit. All prophets have their limit. The limit of some of the great prophets has been 100 years.
"These are few, I ween."
"There have been two still greater ones, whose limit was 400 and 600 years, and one whose limit compassed even 720.
"Gramercy, it is marvelous."
"But what are these in comparison with me? They are nothing."
"What? Canst thou truly look beyond even so vast a stretch of time as 700 years?
My liege, as clear as the vision of an eagle does my prophetic eye penetrate and lay bare the future of this world for nearly 13 centuries and a half."
My land, you should have seen the king's eyes spread slowly open and lift the earth's entire atmosphere as much as an inch. That settled Br'er Merlin. One never had any occasion to prove his facts with these people. All he had to do was to state them. It never occurred to anybody to doubt the statement. Now then, I continued, I could work both kinds of prophecy, the long and the short, if I chose to take the trouble to keep in practice, but I seldom exercise any but the long kind because the other is beneath my dignity. It is properer to Merlin's sort, stump-tail prophets, as we call them in the profession. Of course, I whet up now and then and flirt out a minor prophecy, but not often, hardly ever, in fact. You will remember that there was great talk when you reached the Valley of Holiness about my having prophesied your coming and the very hour of your arrival 2 or 3 days beforehand. Indeed, yes, I mind it now. Well, I could have done it as much as 40 times easier and piled on 1,000 times more detail into the bargain if it had been 500 years away instead of 2 or 3 days. How amazing that it should be so! Yes, a genuine expert can always foretell a thing that is 500 years away easier than he can a thing that's only 500 seconds off. And yet, in reason, it should clearly be the other way. It should be 500 times as easy to foretell the last as the first, for, indeed, it is so close by that one uninspired might almost see it. In truth, the law of prophecy doth contradict the likelihoods, most strangely making the difficult the easy and the easy difficult. It was a wise head. A peasant's cap was no safe disguise for it. You could know it for a king's under a diving belt if you could hear it work its intellect. I had a new trade now and plenty of business in it. The king was as hungry to find out everything that was going to happen during the next 13 centuries as if he were expecting to live in them. From that time out, I prophesied myself bald-headed, trying to supply the demand. I have done some indiscreet things in my day, but this thing of playing myself for a prophet was the worst. Still, it had its ameliorations. A prophet doesn't have to have any brains. They are good to have, of course, for the ordinary exigencies of life, but they are no use in professional work. It is the restfulest vocation there is. When the spirit of prophecy comes upon you, you merely cake your intellect and lay it off in a cool place for a rest, and unship your jaw and leave it alone. It will work itself. The result is prophecy. Every day a knight-errant or so came along, and the sight of them fired the king's martial spirit every time. He would have forgotten himself, sure, and said something to them in a style a suspicious shade or so above his ostensible degree, and so I always got him well out of the road in time. Then he would stand and look with all his eyes, and a proud light would flash from them, and his nostrils would inflate like a war-horse's, and I knew he was longing for a brush with them. But about noon of the third day I had stopped in the road to take a precaution which had been suggested by the whip-stroke that had fallen to my share 2 days before, a caution which I had afterward decided to leave untaken, I was so loath to institute it. But now I had just had a fresher reminder. While striding heedlessly along with jaw spread and intellect at rest, for I was prophesying, I stubbed my toe and fell sprawling. I was so pale I couldn't think for a moment. Then I got softly and carefully up and unstrapped my knapsack. I had that dynamite bomb in it, done up in wool in a box. It was a good thing to have along. The time would come when I could do a valuable miracle with it, maybe, but it was a nervous thing to have about me, and I didn't like to ask the king to carry it. Yet I must either throw it away or think up some safe way to get along with its society. I got it out and slipped it into my scrip, and just then here came a couple of knights. The king stood, stately as a statue, gazing toward them, had forgotten himself again, of course, and before I could get a word of warning out, it was time for him to skip, and well that he did it, too. He supposed they would turn aside to avoid trampling peasant dirt underfoot. When had he ever turned aside himself, or ever had the chance to do it, if a peasant saw him or any other noble knight in time to judiciously save him the trouble? The knight paid no attention to the king at all. It was his place to look out himself, and if he hadn't skipped, he would have been placidly written down and laughed at besides. The king was in a flaming fury and launched out his challenge and epithets with a most royal vigor. The knights were some little distance by now. They halted, greatly surprised, and turned in their saddles and looked back, as if wondering if it might be worthwhile to bother with such scum as we. Then they wheeled and started for us. Not a moment must be lost. I started for them. I passed them at a rattling gait, and as I went by, I flung out a hair-lifting, soul-scorching, 13-jointed insult, which made the king's effort poor and cheap by comparison. I got it out of the 19th century, where they know how. They had such headway that they were nearly to the king before they could check up. Then, frantic with rage, they stood up their horses on their hind hoofs and whirled them around, and the next moment, here they came, breast to breast. I was 70 yards off then, and scrambling up a great boulder at the roadside. When they were within 30 yards of me, they let their long lances droop to a level, depressed their mailed heads, and so, with their horsehair plumes streaming straight out behind, most gallant to see, this lightning express came tearing for me. When they were within 15 yards, I sent that bomb with a sure aim, and it struck the ground just under the horses' noses. Yes, it was a neat thing, very neat and pretty to see. It resembled a steamboat explosion on the Mississippi, and during the next 15 minutes we stood under a steady drizzle of microscopic fragments of knights and hardware and horseflesh. I say we, for the king joined the audience, of course, as soon as he had got his breath again. There was a hole there which would afford steady work for all the people in that region for some years to come, in trying to explain it, I mean. As for filling it up, that service would be comparatively prompt, and would fall to the lot of a select few peasants of that seigneury, and they wouldn't get anything for it either. But I explained it to the king myself. I said it was done with a dynamite bomb. This information did him no damage, because it left him as intelligent as he was before. However, it was a noble miracle in his eyes, and was another settler for Merlin. I thought it well enough to explain that this was a miracle of so rare a sort that it couldn't be done except when the atmospheric conditions were just right. Otherwise he would be encoring it every time we had a good subject, and that would be inconvenient, because I hadn't any more bombs along. End of chapter 27.
So, I'm sure you noticed that the boss, who has at times gone, you know, very poetic on us and talked about the gorgeous countryside and how lovely it is, and has talked about how good some of the people are in spite of their ignorance and all of this, that when given an opportunity, he saves himself and the king, but he does it with a bomb. Now, at the same time, he's also put himself in the way of a whiplash. This is how you will start to see the contradictions start to build, which I think Twain is just too honest a writer to avoid. You know, he's created a character and he has to maintain the truth of that character, but I think he sees clearly who he has created, both strengths and weaknesses, and you're going to see more of the weaknesses cropping up. So we have that. And then, of course, he continues with the superstitious stuff with Arthur, because whether Arthur could understand what he was dealing with or not doesn't really matter. The boss isn't going to give him that opportunity, and he's just going to present it as more magic. So now we go on with chapter 28.
Chapter 28, Drilling the King. On the morning of the fourth day, when it was just sunrise, we had been tramping an hour in the chill dawn, I came to a resolution. The king must be drilled. Things could not go on so. He must be taken in hand and deliberately and conscientiously drilled, or we couldn't ever venture to enter a dwelling. The very cats would know this masquerader for a humbug and no peasant. So I called a halt and said, "Sire, as between clothes and countenance, you are all right. There is no discrepancy. But as between your clothes and your bearing, you are all wrong. There is a most noticeable discrepancy. Your soldierly stride, your lordly port, these will not do. You stand too straight. Your looks are too high, too confident. The cares of a kingdom do not stoop the shoulders. They do not droop the chin. They do not depress the high level of the eye glance. They do not put doubt and fear in the heart and hang out the signs of them in slouching body and unsure step. It is the sordid cares of the lowly born that do these things. You must learn the trick. You must imitate the trademarks of poverty, misery, oppression, insult, and the other several and common inhumanities that sap the manliness out of a man and make him a loyal and proper and approved subject and a satisfaction to his masters. Or the very infants will know you for better than your disguise, and we shall go to pieces at the first hut we stop at. Pray, try to walk like this. The king took careful note and then tried an imitation. Pretty fair, pretty fair. Chin a little lower, please. There, very good. Eyes too high. Pray, don't look at the horizon. Look at the ground, 10 steps in front of you. Ah, that is better. That is very good. Wait, please. You betray too much vigor, too much decision. You want more of a shamble. Look at me, please. This is what I mean. Now you are getting it. That is the idea. At least it sort of approaches it. Yes, that is pretty fair. But there is a great big something wanting. I don't quite know what it is. Please walk 30 yards so I can get a perspective on the thing. Now then, your head's right, speed's right, shoulders right, eyes right, chin right, gait, carriage, general style right, everything's right. And yet the fact remains the aggregate's wrong. The account don't balance. Do it again, please. Now I think I begin to see what it is. Yes, I've struck it. You see, the genuine spiritlessness is wanting. That's what's the trouble. It's all amateur, mechanical details all right, almost to a hair. Everything's about the delusion perfect, except that it don't delude. What, then, must one do to prevail? Let me think. I can't seem to quite get at it. In fact, there isn't anything that can right the matter but practice. This is a good place for it. Roots and stony ground to break up your stately gait. A region not liable to interruption. Only one field and one hut in sight, and they so far away that nobody could see us from there. It will be well to move a little off the road and put in the whole day drilling you, sire. After the drill had gone on a little while, I said, "Now, sire, imagine that we are at the door of the hut yonder, and the family are before us. Proceed, please. Accost the head of the house." The king unconsciously straightened up like a monument and said with frozen austerity, "Varlet, bring a seat, and serve to me what cheer ye have. Ah, your grace, that is not well done. In what lacketh it? These people do not call each other varlets." "Nay, is that true?" "Yes, only those above them call them so." "Then must I try again? I will call him villain." No, for he may be a freeman." Peradventure I should call him goodman." "That would answer, your grace, but it would be still better if you said friend or brother."
"Brother? To dirt like that?"
"Ah, but we are pretending to be dirt like that, too."
"It is even true, I will say it. Brother, bring a seat, and thereto what cheer ye have withal. Now 'tis right."
"Not quite, not wholly right. You have asked for one, not us. For one, not both. Food for one, a seat for one." The king looked puzzled. He wasn't a very heavyweight intellectually. His head was an hourglass. It could stow an idea, but it had to do it a grain at a time, not the whole idea at once.
"Would you have a seat also, and sit?"
"If I did not sit, the man would perceive that we were only pretending to be equals, and playing the deception pretty poorly, too."
"It is well and truly said. How wonderful is truth, come it in whatsoever unexpected form it may.
Yes, he must bring out seats and food for both, and in serving us present not ewer and napkin with more show of respect to the one than to the other.
And there is even yet a detail that needs correcting. He must bring nothing outside. We will go in among the dirt, and possibly other repulsive things, and take the food with the household, and after the fashion of the house, and all on equal terms, except the man be of the serf class. And finally, there will be no ewer and no napkin, whether he be serf or free. Please walk again, my liege. There, it is better. It is the best yet, but not perfect. The shoulders have known no ignobler burden than iron mail, and they will not stoop.
Give me, then, the bag. I will learn the spirit that goeth with burdens that have not honor. It is the spirit that stoopeth the shoulders, I ween, and not the weight. For armor is heavy, yet it is a proud burden, and a man standeth straight in it. Nay, butt me no buts, offer me no objections, I will have the thing, strap it upon my back. He was complete now with that knapsack on, and looked as little like a king as any man I had ever seen. But it was an obstinate pair of shoulders. They could not seem to learn the trick of stooping with any sort of deceptive naturalness. The drill went on, I prompting and correcting. Now, make believe you are in debt, and eaten up by relentless creditors. You are out of work, which is horseshoeing, let us say, and can get none. And your wife is sick, your children are crying because they are hungry, and so on and so on. I drilled him as representing in turn all sorts of people out of luck and suffering dire privations and misfortunes. But, Lord, it was only just words, words. They meant nothing in the world to him. I might just as well have whistled. Words realize nothing, vivify nothing to you, unless you have suffered in your own person the thing which the words try to describe. There are wise people who talk ever so knowingly and complacently about the working classes, and satisfy themselves that a day's hard intellectual work is very much harder than a day's hard manual toil, and is righteously entitled to much bigger pay. Why, they really think that, you know, because they know all about the one, but haven't tried the other. But I know all about both, and so far as I am concerned, there isn't money enough in the universe to hire me to swing a pickaxe 30 days. But I will do the hardest kind of intellectual work for just as near nothing as you can cipher it down, and I will be satisfied, too. Intellectual work is misnamed. It is a pleasure, a dissipation, and is its own highest reward. The poorest paid architect, engineer, general, author, sculptor, painter, lecturer, advocate, legislator, actor, preacher, singer, is constructively in heaven when he is at work. And as for the musician with a fiddle bow in his hand who sits in the midst of a great orchestra with the ebbing and flowing tides of divine sound washing over him, why, certainly he is at work, if you wish to call it that, but Lord, it's a sarcasm just the same. The law of work does seem utterly unfair, but there it is, and nothing can change it. The higher the pay and enjoyment the worker gets out of it, the higher shall be his pay in cash also. And it's also the very law of those transparent swindles, transmissible nobility, and kingship. End of chapter 28.
Interesting how some things change and some things stay the same. So we are now set up for the continuing adventure that King Arthur and the boss will have, and it does get darker as we continue on with the book. So, thank you for sticking with it. I know for some of you it has been difficult, but I appreciate it. And I promise it's gonna be, the payoff's good, really. All right, so last little announcement. I am going to put an extra on the iPhone iTouch application. Now, I have written to them again to find out when in the world they are going to come out with their Droid and their BlackBerry app, but as of this recording, they've not written back again. So, I'm working on it. But in the meantime, I'm putting this extra on. If it works, then I will be releasing these extras that have to do with the Craft Lit Nitty Tour to the iPhone app, and then the next week putting those on a dedicated page on the show notes so everyone will have access. I don't know if it's going to work on the iPhone app, so if it doesn't, go ahead and email me. You can email directly from the application. If it does work, email me and let me know, because you can do that directly from the application. That would be great. And, you know, trying to do more and interesting things with all of this technology stuff that allegedly works. Who knows? It's all too much sometimes. All right, I'm going to go work on What Would Madame Defarge Knit? The pattern book, which will be coming to you in February next year. 2011. Very exciting. Very exciting stuff. All sorts of stuff. Don't forget to forward the writing-a-life.com site to anyone you think might need a little bit of extra help. Or, you know, parents who really are, they're over helping their kids with writing. I know it was always tears in my family, so I can empathize. But we work with the parents and the children to make sure that everybody knows what they need to do and everybody gets the help they need and no more tears. So, on that happy note, have a great week. I'll talk to you soon. Bye. Please remember to support the people who support Craft Lit. Visit Knitting Out Loud. Listen while you knit. And Knit Circus online magazine, offering 3 rings of knitting, sewing, and fun. You can check out the summer issue at www.knitcircus.com. And please visit the blogs and sites of Craft Lit supporters. Those links can be found in the sidebar of the show notes. The show notes can be found at craftlit.com. Craft Lit can also be accessed by its own iPhone application. You can purchase it at the iPhone or iTouch application store, or you can subscribe free at iTunes. Craft Lit is made possible by the generous support of its listeners, and for that, I am truly grateful. And remember, if your hands are too busy to pick up a book, at least you can turn one.